Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for September 11th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, influenza and the transmissibility and control of the pandemic H1N1 virus, understanding the genetic complexity behind multiple gene adaptations, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about scanning for schizophrenia from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
According to the World Health Organization, or WHO, the pandemic influenza A H1N1 virus continues to be the predominant circulating virus of influenza, both in the northern and southern hemisphere. And as of the end of August, the WHO reported that over 2,800 people have died from the swine origin influenza. To put that into perspective, every year, just in the United States, an estimated 36,000 people die from influenza-related reasons from the seasonal flu, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So, the concern with the pandemic influenza A, H1N1 virus, is that far more people may be infected than with a typical seasonal influenza virus, because the pandemic virus appears to be much more transmissible. In a paper published online by Science, Ira Longini and colleagues report their estimates of the transmissibility of pandemic influenza and model the number of influenza cases in the U.S. given several vaccination strategies. The best vaccination strategy, Longini says, is to start vaccinating people in the Northern Hemisphere now. I spoke with Longini from his office at the University of Washington in Seattle.
We have found that pandemic influenza H1N1 is, for statistical estimates of spread in households and schools and communities, is a fairly transmissible virus, probably on the order of the transmissibility of pandemic influenza H2N2 in 1957. And what we've observed is that the virus is spreading rather easily wherever introduced in schools and households and even out of season, for example, during the summer in the U.S. and in Europe and the Northern Hemisphere. We've observed large epidemics in the Southern Hemisphere, the temperate Southern Hemisphere over there, fall and winter. And so we're expecting considerable transmission very soon in the U.S. and the temperate Northern Hemisphere. And probably the only effective means for control is a vaccine. Vaccine is coming from a variety of manufacturers, is being tested, and peers will start getting enough vaccine for about 12 to 20% of the U.S. population starting in mid-October.
Under your team's model for how the virus spreads, what's the best strategy for vaccination in the United States?
Yeah, clearly the best strategy is a rapid vaccination of school children and children first, followed by the general population in terms of mitigating spread. Overall strategy, one should add the high-risk groups and the essential health workers as well. So a combination of vaccinating high-risk and essential workforce along with school children as rapidly as possible, and then following that with general population vaccination.
Could you extrapolate to other countries and recommend the same vaccination strategy there? Or are there factors or data particular to the United States that suggest the same strategy for the U.S. might not be the best for other countries?
Well, I think in terms of dynamics of how influenza spreads, that strategy would be highly effective in any country in the world. The biggest problem is the supply of vaccine. So you have to have enough vaccine to cover at least 50 to 70% of children to make this an effective strategy. If the supply is less than that, then it's much better to concentrate vaccine in the high risk and the essential health workforce.
Beyond looking at the spread of past epidemics and the apparent transmissibility of this year's influenza in other countries, is there any other data that you and your team used in making your model?
Well, we do have observations, global observations from past pandemics. And so some of that went into our model. And clearly, this pandemic is very similar so far in transmission to the 1957-58 Asian H2N2 epidemic. In that case, the early spread and even subsequent spread was largely, at least 50% of all cases were children, especially school children. The epidemic spread from the northern to the southern hemispheres in almost the same pattern we're currently observing. And the population was in the U.S. was well seeded over the summer, with sporadic outbreaks occurring wherever children congregated. So we were able to estimate parameters directly from the spread of this virus in U.S. households, in a school in the United States, and then in overall in Mexico, and combine this with observations from past pandemics to put together the model as we're currently using it.
Of the influenza cases reported in the Southern Hemisphere, where the influenza season is underway, what percentage of the cases are this H1N1 or influenza A strain?
Yeah, virtually anywhere from 70 to 98% in Chile, Argentina, Australia, and New Zealand have been pandemic H1N1 strains, among typable strains. So there's been very little seasonal influenza A, H3N2, or AH1N1. So wherever the virus has gotten a good hold, it's replaced the seasonal strains, except with the possible exception of South Africa, where data is a bit confusing from there, so it's hard to interpret.
Is the virus mutating much?
No, the virus is genetically remarkably stable. So the current strains, if you put them on a phylogenetic tree and analyze those strains, they're almost identical to the original strains we isolated in California and in Mexico way back in late April.
So what's your team's estimate, then, for the effectiveness of the influenza vaccine currently being produced?
Our estimate, just based on the stability of the strain and what we know about seasonal vaccine production and efficacy, is that it'll be a good homologous match. So we should get a good match between the circulating wild strain and the vaccine. We've also simulated the heterologous case where the match is not as good and still could have effective use of large quantities of vaccine.
And if left unchecked and given the data thus far from around the world, at what rate does this strain spread and how deadly is it?
It spreads at the rate at which about maybe as high as 30% of the population would become ill by the end of the epidemic, which is consistent with what we call the basic reproductive number we're estimating to be about 1.6 or so. And that's pretty much what we're observing within the confines of, the data collected, which have problems because of underreporting and so on. So far as severity of disease and mortality, the virus has been relatively mild. We're guesstimating a case fatality rate of about 1 in 10,000 clinical cases. So that's pretty consistent with seasonal flu. The big difference being the fatalities are concentrated in the younger age groups for pandemic H1N1 and tend to be concentrated in the very young and the very old for seasonal flu. So relatively mild disease, but some fatality and some severity in the usual high-risk groups, such as pregnant women, but also in young, healthy adults as well.
Does that make it more similar to past strains of pandemic influenza?
Well, as far as the fact that young, healthy adults are affected more, that's consistent with the 1918 strain of H1N1. But the overall death rate's much lower for this virus than it was in 1918. In 1918, it was on the order of 1 in 100 cases died, and we're talking about 1 in 10,000 in this case, so two orders of magnitude less virulent and severe.
And under your team's model, if the vaccine is to be administered, when does it need to start being administered?
Well, ideally, if the pandemic follows the pattern we think it will, ideally it would have been good to start vaccination by mid-September, but we're currently looking at mid-October for a starting date for when the first batches of vaccine will be distributed. on the order of enough to cover about 12 to 15% of the population every month after that.
So right now would be best, but a month delay is inevitable, it sounds like.
Yeah, it could be a bit late. The only other point is, even if we're late with vaccination, this virus is probably going to be with us for many years to come in various forms, maybe as much as a couple of decades. So I think the vaccination is very important. Try to at least get people primed and start building up population level protection against this virus.
Because there can be several waves of this.
There could be a second wave after January 1st, early winter wave. And then certainly there'll be subsequent flu seasons every year afterwards. Usually 2 or 3 years after a new pandemic strain is introduced, we do tend to have elevated mortality and morbidity for a couple of years, and not just the year of the first big wave.
Ira Longini, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ira Longini of the University of Washington of Seattle is senior author of a paper on the transmissibility and control of pandemic influenza A H1N1 virus. Read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. The idea behind geoengineering is to counteract the effects of global climate change. Several science institutions are studying geoengineering, including, most recently, the Royal Society in the United Kingdom. Here with more about it is Science's Policy Forum editor, Brad Weibel.
Geoengineering the Earth to reverse the impacts of global climate change may still sound a bit like science fiction. However, in the United Kingdom on September 1st, the prestigious Royal Society released a report concluding that some of the methods that have been proposed are likely to be technically feasible, although major uncertainties on effectiveness, costs, and environmental impacts exist and should be studied. The report considered two categories of geoengineering methods: techniques to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and techniques to reflect some of the sun's light and heat back into space. As summarized by Martin Rees, president of the Society, nothing should divert us from the main priority of reducing global greenhouse gas emissions. But if such reductions achieve too little, too late, there will surely be pressure to consider a plan B, to seek ways to counteract the climatic effects of greenhouse gas emissions by geoengineering. Earlier in the summer, the American Meteorological Society, or AMS, released a policy statement on the subject as well, finding that geoengineering could contribute to a comprehensive risk management strategy to slow climate change, but could also create considerable new risks. The AMS statement recommends enhanced research on the scientific and technological potential, as well as a coordinated study of historical, ethical, legal, and social implications of geoengineering.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with the policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. It's one of the classic cases of evolutionary adaptation. Inland and barrier island mice from Alabama to Florida along the U.S. coast have coat or hair color that matches their environment, the evolution of which appears to be driven by selection for camouflage. As Science's Elizabeth Panisi reports in this week's issue, scientists have learned that three genes account for the underlying genetic complexity for coat color, and now researchers are trying to use the same scientific techniques to understand the genetic underpinnings of mouse behavioral traits, too. Here's Elizabeth Panisi.
So the researchers are looking at the genetics underlying natural variation in populations of mice, some of which live on the mainland and some of which live on barrier islands off of the Gulf of Florida. And this story is about how they go about that work.
With what goal in mind?
So the goal is eventually to identify the genes that lead to different traits. This story talks about two projects that they're doing. One is to look at the genetics of coat color, because mainland mice are darker, dark brown, and the mice that live on the beaches are pale and have a lot of light coloration. And the second goal is to look at differences in burrowing behavior between this species of mice and another closely related species of mice, where this species of mice digs these deep, elaborate burrows, whereas the other species of mice have very short, shallow burrows. And the idea is you catch the mice, you look at their genetic profiles, and you correlate their genetic profiles with their digging characteristics or their coat color characteristics. And from there, you start identifying what part of the genome is involved in causing those traits and eventually narrowing down to the actual genes themselves.
Now, we used to hear all about the gene for this disease or the gene for that, but you're saying genes, plural. The idea being that several are interacting with one another in order to make these things happen?
Right. There are very few traits that are what you would call single gene traits. Usually there's several genes that are influencing, say, coat color or burrowing behavior. In this particular case, they've narrowed it down to three genes that all affect the coat color patterns on these beach mice.
Do those three genes account for all variation in these mice?
I wouldn't say all, just like you never say never, but it's definitely most of it.
How about burrowing behavior? Have they got a gene target in mind?
Well, with burrowing behavior, there's a lot less known. With coat colorations, pigment genes have been studied for a long time, and so there were a lot of hints about what genes might be involved, and turned out some of those genes were involved. With burrowing behavior, they really don't know very much. It's not like they have a gene for burrowing behavior, or they even have a clue about how many genes it would take to sort of cause one kind of mice to make a deep burrow, another kind of mouse to make a shallow burrow. So that project will be a little bit harder to figure out.
Now, in locating several genes for a particular trait or behavior, is it a matter of just scaling up from finding one gene, or have scientists developed new tools in order to find the genes and how they're interacting with one another?
When you're trying to find a gene responsible for a trait, whether it's one gene or many genes, the procedure is similar. What you do is you start with parents, one with the trait that you're looking for and one without the trait you're looking for. You breed those parents, and then you breed their offspring, and you look at what proportion of the traits show up. And if it's one gene, you get a very simple proportion that's reproducible. If it's multiple genes, you'll get a lot of variation. So it won't be that you'll get the trait or not the trait. You'll get sort of a little bit of the trait, or a lot of the trait, or varying amounts of the trait. So you'll get this variation. And what you have to do is start looking at how this variation correlates with the genetic makeups of the offspring. So you need, instead of a few offspring, you need hundreds of offspring in order to start being able to tell how many different genes are involved.
Obviously, we can't do those kinds of experiments with people. Is this kind of research going to help with understanding human traits, human diseases, human behaviors even?
I would say this helps in a very indirect way. I mean, the more you learn about how genes interact and what the rules of genetics are, the better off you are for understanding how traits are affected and transmitted in humans. But in terms of a direct application, not yet. But one of the things that's happening with this particular project and other projects is that the researchers are bringing to bear a whole lot of different techniques. So they're bringing to bear genetics, they're bringing to bear ecology, they're bringing to bear cell biology. I mean, they're doing all sorts of things to try to get a handle on not just what the genes are, but how they work and what they actually do in the cell, in the body, to make the changes that they occur. And all this information will help us have a fundamental understanding of these sorts of genes and proteins.
Elizabeth Panisi, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Science's Elizabeth Panisi writes on how beach life favors blonde mice in this week's issue. Also in this week's Science, wind power. Michael McElroy and colleagues report in a paper their analysis that wind power in China could supply the projected demand for electricity in that country for the year 2030, if the price point per kilowatt hour is set at 7.6 U.S. cents for the next 10 years. The authors calculate that this shift in electricity generation would virtually eliminate carbon dioxide emissions from China's power sector. Currently, coal-fired power plants account for about 80% of China's electricity production, which generate carbon dioxide. And since 2006, China has produced more carbon dioxide per year than any other country. But the authors note their analysis does not explicitly account for the cost required to connect China's potential future source of wind energy to the existing electric grid, and that the shift to wind power would require a major investment of resources over the long run. But the authors report such an investment may be somewhat offset by benefits in air quality. That's because the value of health damage associated with air pollution in China has been estimated at 0.7 to 4.3% of China's gross domestic product. Read the paper in this week's Science, Potential for Wind-Generated Electricity in China. Finally today, David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about scanning for schizophrenia. What kind of scanners are they using for that, Dave?
Well, Rob, this is a brain scanner, and the study is all about, you know, you and I can go to our doctor and say, you know, I want to test for high cholesterol to see if I'm at risk, say, for heart disease. But we can't go to our doctor and say, hey, can you give me a test to see if I'm at high risk for schizophrenia or any other type of mental illness? Researchers just haven't developed a good diagnostic for predicting whether people are going to develop these types of disorders. So this study is all about, can researchers find maybe something in the brain, some sort of telltale sign that will tell them whether somebody's at a higher risk for developing, say, schizophrenia.
So an fMRI or functional magnetic resonance imaging, that kind of brain scan?
Right. This kind of scan measures blood flow in the brain, and the regions that have more blood flow are considered more active. And what the researchers found in this study is that there seems to be three regions of the brain under fMRI that are different between people that are schizophrenic and people that don't have schizophrenia. And two of these regions are in the frontal cortex. But the most interesting region was this 5 millimeter long part of the hippocampus that's called the CA1 subfield. And the hippocampus is a part of the brain that's involved in learning and memory. And what the researchers saw in this CA1 subfield was that they saw a lot more activity in this region in people that had schizophrenia versus people that didn't have schizophrenia. You know, this is important in itself because researchers are always looking for parts of the brain that are involved in mental illness. But it doesn't tell us anything about prediction because these people already had schizophrenia. But the researchers said, well, you know, if people that have schizophrenia have more activity in this region, maybe this region can be used as a marker for schizophrenia. Maybe people that are going to develop schizophrenia also have more activity in this region. And so that's really the diagnostic part of this study, was that they took 18 patients with what are called prodromal symptoms. And these are symptoms that about 75% of people that go on to develop schizophrenia have. They're things like, you know, mild hallucinations, like hearing voices whispered in the wind, or paranoia, you know, you think your friends are saying something behind your back. And so researchers took 18 people that had these symptoms, and they followed them for 2 years, and occasionally they do fMRI scans. And what they noticed is that about 70% of these people that actually went on to develop schizophrenia showed 50% more activity in the CA1 region than people with these prodromal symptoms that didn't go on to develop schizophrenia. So this, you know, even though it's not perfect, this is the most powerful indication researchers have so far that somebody may go on to develop schizophrenia.
So it's not a test then for people of the general public, but people who are already potentially on the road towards schizophrenia.
Right. The analogy the researchers use is somebody who already has, say, a family history of heart disease going in to have their cholesterol levels checked versus somebody who has no history. So this test right now would really be most useful for people who already feel like they may be predisposed to some sort of mental illness rather than just an average member of the general public.
So they might be able to start treatment earlier.
Exactly.
Okay. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, this next story is about two different bird species that sing the same song.
The birds can't tell the difference? What's the song used for?
Well, Rob, this is a territorial song. This is a song a male bird would sing to tell other males, hey, get off my property. This is my area. I want you to go away.
And it's an effective deterrent for both species?
Yeah, and that's what it turns out is really interesting about this study. Usually, you know, birds, when they have a song, it's very unique to their species, whether it's a mating song or a territorial song or whatever. But listen to these two songs. You're going to hear two different bird species. Here's the territorial song that a male from the first species makes. Now here's the territorial song of a male from the second species.
It does sound the same.
And that's really unusual. And the question is, well, first of all, the question is, you know, it sounds the same to you and me, Rob, but does it sound the same to the birds? And it does. And the birds we're talking about here are South American antbirds. The two species are one called the yellow-breasted antbird, and the other one is called the Peruvian antbird. And what's really sort of interesting here is you wouldn't expect these birds to sound very similar. First of all, they've been separated genetically for over 3 million years, so they've really been on these divergent evolutionary paths for a very long time. Also, they look differently. As their name implies, the yellow-breasted antbird has a yellow chest, and the Peruvian antbird actually has a white chest. And there's a bunch of other differences. But as you can hear, the songs sound very similar. But the researchers wanted to see, do the songs actually sound similar to the birds? And so they taped over 500 songs from over 150 birds of both of these species. And they also taped some territorial songs of some related species. And what they found was that when they played these songs to either of these two antbird species that we mentioned, the birds couldn't distinguish them. So if you played a song from the first species to the second species, it reacted as if a bird was invading its territory and it came flying in trying to get rid of this other bird. But if they played either of these two species songs from another related species, the birds didn't react. So the birds can tell the difference between their song and songs from other species.
So what do researchers suppose is going on here?
Well, what they think is going on is these two birds, although they usually in different habitats, there are some areas where they live in the same place. One bird tends to prefer forest and the other tends to prefer bamboo, but there's areas in the Amazon that are both forest and bamboo, and you can find these two birds overlapping. And the idea is it's more efficient evolutionarily if these birds sing the same song. If a bird from the first species sings a territorial song that says, "Get off my property," if it's understood by bird B, he can get rid of both males from his own species and males from this other species by singing the song, rather than, say, having to sing two different songs or there being some confusion about exactly what's going on.
Because otherwise they'd compete for the same resources.
And researchers say this is a case of convergent evolution. Convergent evolution basically means when two different species evolve the same kind of traits. Imagine, you know, a fly has wings and a bird has wings, but they're obviously very completely different types of organisms. And here you have a case where these birds have evolved the same song, even though they are different species that have been separated by a long time.
Or they might have just kept the same song for 3 million years.
Yeah, that's possible too.
Okay, so last story this week. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, this last story is also about evolution, and it deals with a big question in evolution, which is, how do we evolve new traits without messing up our genes? And this all goes back to how evolution works in the first place. You know, these mutations in various genes can cause new traits, you know, whether it's different eye color or height or whatever it is, or even more brain power. But mutations can also do bad things. Mutations can muck up a gene, and so they could disrupt a critical function, like, say, brain development that would kill you. So the question is, how does evolution work on these genes if there's such a good chance that these genes are going to get disrupted? And the answer seems to be that we make backup copies. So mutations can happen in one gene, and if things get mucked up, you've still got this backup.
And somehow the organism might use this backup or stick with the original gene?
Well, Rob, the idea is your body still has these two genes. So if one is still functional, even if the other one's mucked up, you're still producing, say, this critical protein or this critical function, whatever you need to survive. And in this new study, Rob, they looked at fish. And they wanted to see, you know, can we actually sort of force evolution to happen, you know, on this small laboratory scale? And they took these zebrafish, which are these tiny fish, very popular laboratory model, and they fed them a bunch of chemicals which would cause their DNA to mutate. And then they looked for unusual traits. And one of the fish had this interesting mutation which made it almost scaleless. It didn't have very many scales, and it's very reminiscent of a domestic carp breed that has been bred not to have scales to make it easier to clean. And when the researchers said, okay, what's causing, you know, we've just sort of caused evolution to happen on a small scale here. We've created these scaleless fish. What's causing this to happen? And they traced the scaleless attribute back to a gene called fibroblast growth factor receptor 1, or FGFR1. And they said, okay, we've seen these mutations in this gene. These mutations must be causing the scaleless appearance. is there a backup for this gene? You know, do these fish have a spare gene that allowed us to sort of work on this extra copy? And that's exactly what they found. They scanned the genome and they found that there was a backup of this FGFR1 gene. And that makes sense because this gene is actually so important that if you had really mucked up this gene, you would have killed the fish. The fish would have died as an embryo because it's so critical to development. But, you know, this is all done in the laboratory, Rob, and they wanted to see, does this actually happen in real life? So they went to carp, which also have this attribute, and they found that carp that has this special kind of scaling also has mutations in its FGFR1 gene. And just like the zebrafish, it has a backup of this FGFR1 gene that's completely untouched by mutations. So this is sort of a nice proof of concept that in the wild, organisms have these backup genes which stay relatively normal, but they have another copy which can get mutated and occasionally leads to new and important traits.
Now, they've done genome sequencing on a whole bunch of organisms at this point. How many of my genes have backups?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure if they know that, but they do know that about 25% of the zebrafish's 17,000 genes are duplicated. So we're talking about an enormous amount of duplication happening in the zebrafish's genome. And you would expect that a lot of other organisms also have this massive amount of duplication. And that also lends further credence to the theory that this duplication is really a critical part of how evolution works. It really gives all of us these backup genes that allows evolution to proceed and allows organisms to develop new traits over time because these critical genes are still backed up.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you covering on Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about green neurons. And these aren't neurons that are the color green. These are neurons that are very energy efficient in the brain. And for Science Insider, the science policy blog, we're looking into a story about a very popular journal, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and how it's changing an important part of how papers are submitted. This deals with a controversy about how this journal has accepted papers in the past. And also, there's been a new report released this week about the future of U.S. spaceflight. And it turns out, the report says that missions to the moon, Mars, and beyond are not feasible with the current budget. And so we're looking at what the implications of this report are for future U.S. space science. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the September 11th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.